seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture.
This
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mukbil Yabaro, and here's what's coming up.
I think the main point is, you know, this is a man-made conflict, and this the famine as a result is also man-made. And the solution is can only be man-made.
That was Lenny Kinsley of the World Food Program on starvation conditions that are spreading in North Darfur. Also, authorities say militia fighters in northeastern Congo killed at least 55 people, and Kenya fights rising sexual abuse of children. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Sudanese refugees who have made it to Chad speak of burying infants who died of hunger in Darfur's Zemzem displacement camp and say that people are dying in frequent rapid support forces shelling of the camp. Reporter Henry Wilkins spoke with refugees in Agri, Chad.
This man arrived at a refugee site at Chad's border with Sudan 2 days earlier. After making a perilous 340-kilometer journey on foot from the Zemzem displacement camp in North Darfur. The camp is gripped by famine and besieged by the hostile Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The man asked to remain anonymous for security reasons.
I swear, what is happening in Zemzem is devastating. Explosions have turned citizens into corpses. No money and no food. Sometimes you go the whole day eating only one meal.
He recounted how he and other members of the community in Zemzem had to bury 25 infants who had died of starvation. According to the UN, parts of Darfur are in a state of famine, the world's first in 7 years, including the Zemzem camp. Aid groups and residents say the camp of 300,000 inhabitants is also being regularly shelled by the RSF, one of the warring parties in Sudan's civil war that evolved from the Janjaweed militia. Another Zemzem resident who fled to Chad also asked to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals.
When we first arrived, we thought it would be safe because humanitarian organizations were based there. We assumed the Janjaweed wouldn't attack them, but they did.
He said the young and the elderly were the first to perish.
The elderly and children were the most vulnerable. Many families lost their young ones due to malnutrition and lack of medical care.
The UN's World Food Programme says the famine stems from conflict. Lenny Kinsley is head of communications for the World Food Programme in Sudan.
I think the main point is, you know, this is a man-made conflict, and the famine as a result is also man-made. And the solution can only be man-made. A humanitarian pause would be required to ramp up to the scale that's needed to prevent this from really becoming one of the world's worst hunger or famine situations in decades.
As the UN continues to distribute food for the refugees here in Chad, it says the famine in Darfur is expected to spread to 5 more regions of Sudan by mid-2025. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
Authorities say militia fighters in northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo attacked a cluster of villages and a camp for displaced people, killing at least 55 civilians. The camp leader told the Associated Press today that the death toll could rise as bodies continue to be retrieved from burned-down houses. She blamed gunmen from the Kodeko militia, one of more than 120 armed groups fighting in the region, most for land and control of mines with valuable minerals. She said the United Nations peacekeeping force and the DRC government troops intervened, but were overwhelmed by the more numerous attacks. Zimbabwe's traditional stores are struggling to stay afloat as customers flock to informal vendors to buy cheaper products amid a struggling economy. Meanwhile, the government is working to ensure it does not lose critical tax revenue from informal business sales. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Like other Zimbabweans, 47-year-old Ed Nakatio buys her groceries from informal street vendors in Harare, who usually appear after hours to avoid the police. Katio says these shops are cheaper than the conventional shops. Plus, there are no queues. You pick your items, pay, and then you leave. Economists say traditional stores are struggling to compete with the vendors because Zimbabwe's new currency, the ZiG, or Zimbabwean gold, is fixed at 26.32 against the US dollar. But the money changers say the rate is around 40 ZiG per US dollar on the black market. Street vendor Takuzwa Saki agrees. Saki says the fixed rate makes goods expensive in traditional shops, so shoppers end up coming to buy from us vendors. Unlike informal markets, traditional shops are forced to accept the local currency, and shop owners say they must go on the black market for the US dollar to buy more stock. Economists say the Zimbabwe government is also losing important tax revenue from the informal market sales. Edima Hembe is an independent economist.
There is no country which has developed on the backbone of informal economy. You get to the government cannot have enough revenue to do government duties like your provision of education, provision of health and other stuff. So it's a failure.
Mahembe says retailers and wholesale operators are also struggling in Zimbabwe's economic environment. That includes a volatile currency and taxes, fees and regulations that retailers say make it difficult to stay afloat. Innocent Marimo is with the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers.
What we are currently calling for government is to intervene, and particularly our president, Dr. Emmerson Ndambuzo Mnangagwa, to rescue us from this situation that we are currently in, and rescue us of what's left of the formal retail and wholesale sector.
The Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers has asked the government to formalize the informal sector and create a more equitable environment for all sides. Meanwhile, officials say government agencies are working to register informal vendors. Mishe Gova is Zimbabwe's Commissioner of Domestic Taxes.
We want to increase our tax base and make sure that the fiscus gets what is due to it. We have put up what we call the kiosks. These kiosks are basically they've got laptops and computers where informal traders can get access to our system and register without any challenge.
All informal traders that VOA spoke with said they were not aware of such registration. Holamas Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A recent report says Kenya is experiencing an increase in online sexual exploitation and abuse of children. The report says Kenya is a hotspot for sexual abuse of children as young as 12. Victoria Munga reports.
For young people like Winnie Muyam, accessing digital platforms was her way to connect with friends and entertainment until a day last year when the 17-year-old Muyam says strangers began to chat with her.
They started talking to me as a friend, telling me how beautiful I was. And from there, they started sending their picture, wanting to see my private part, and I felt so bad about it.
She says her efforts to flag her abusers through the platform's reporting tools were futile. Her complaint was not acted upon. While Muyam was able to avoid exploitation, up to 13% of minors like her online have been exploited or abused, according to a survey by Child Fund International and Africa Child Forum. A majority of the targeted children are 12 to 17 years old. The fund's child advocacy and protection manager, Eunice Kilundo, explains that the perpetrators try to play on their victims' desperation for affection.
They will possess very good friends. They would even give children rewards and all that, and, you know, lure them into going deeper and deeper. Up to the place where probably they may want children to send their nudes and all that.
UNICEF says in a fast-changing digital world, parents, caregivers, communities and governments face new challenges in keeping children safe. Researchers say a low capacity to investigate and prosecute online sexual exploitation in Africa creates a fertile ground for potential offenders, so Kenyan authorities are training officers in the justice system on handling such cases. Kilundo says concerted efforts to combat such abuse will go a long way.
It's high time everybody in the children's sector or even outside the children's sector, the corporates, governments and everyone demonstrate commitment and concern.
Kenyan law prohibits any sexual involvement with children under 18 years old, including online, without permission of a parent or guardian. Dennis Otieno, senior counsel for Kenya's Federation of Female Lawyers, told VOA that although such crimes are prosecutable, some caregivers are oblivious to it, and sensitizing them is crucial.
The report rate for such cases is very low. And I would substantiate that with the reason that many people still do not understand that there are crimes that can be committed through social media spaces.
Over 22 million people in Kenya have access to the internet, according to national data. And with increasing access to digital platforms, authorities believe programs such as this training will help keep children online safe. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Mukbil Yabaro in Washington. And we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. The United Nations International Organization for Migration says it is deeply alarmed by dozens of migrants' bodies found in mass graves in southeastern Libya. On Sunday, Libyan authorities said they found 28 bodies in the southeastern district of Kufra near a site where they were allegedly detained and tortured. The IOM yesterday expressed shock and concern. The IOM said at least 30 bodies were found in a mass grave in Kufra, whereas as many as 70 others may have been buried there. The French news agency AFP reports 19 bodies were discovered in Jakara, some 400 kilometers south of the coastal city of Benghazi. Conservationists in Kenya are using an artificial intelligence-powered application to monitor forest degradation and launch reforestation projects. The information the application collects is also used to project the amount of carbon that can be stored by a growing patch of forest. Juma Majanga reports from Nyeri, Kenya.
Cedric Kiplimo is assembling his artificial intelligence-powered stereoscopic camera at Dedan Kimathi University of Technology in Kenya's central region. Next, he will head out to collect data.
We really do not have granular data on forests. Developed nations usually have things called national forest inventories, which are essentially huge collections of data sets on forests, individual measurements of these trees, from sample plots and so on. In Africa, we don't have that.
So Kiplimo is trying to change that with the help of an AI-powered application called Tree Vision. Tree Vision uses stereoscopic images of trees to provide a three-dimensional understanding of the area. It does this by generating data on trees' height, diameter, and other features. It also indicates the level of degradation in a given area. This information can be used to inform reforestation efforts and monitor the growth of trees in reforested areas. The app can also project the amount of carbon that can be stored within a growing patch of forest. All this will make the work of conservationists much easier. Shira Maina, an associate professor of electrical engineering at Dedan Kimathi University of Technology.
If you can take away some of the burdensome tasks that they may have to do and make them automate some of them and also be able to capture data more easily, it allows them to monitor larger areas and then save their time to maybe make now to implement on interventions.
The Global Forest Watch says Kenya lost about 8% of its humid primary forest or old-growth rainforest over the past two decades. and that in part led to a 12% decrease in Kenya's total tree cover. Conservationists say human activities contributed to that loss. James Mwangombe of the Kenya Forest Service.
A lot of our people out there resort to harvesting trees, probably for charcoal or timber or something else in order to survive. The other losses experienced is the kind of land use that is happening. A lot of people are clearing even very marginal areas to do farming.
The Kenyan government launched a campaign in late 2022 to plant 15 billion trees by 2032. James Mwangombe says innovations like Tree Vision can help Kenya reach that target.
So such innovations would be very welcome because they'll cut down on cost, both labor and actual finance, as compared to when you have officers on the ground to go and do the actual counting and assessments.
As Kenya works to restore its lost tree cover, Kiplimo hopes his innovation can help restoration efforts succeed. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nyeri, Kenya.
Tuberculosis remains a critical public health issue in many countries and is a leading cause of death in South Africa. Over the past 6 years, the BEAT tuberculosis study conducted in South Africa and focused on children and pregnant women has revealed a promising new oral treatment that could mark a significant breakthrough in the fight against drug-resistant TB. Zahir Kasim reports.
These pills are part of a drug trial in South Africa that may help revolutionize tuberculosis therapy. A new regimen cured 85 to 90% patients with drug-resistant TB, up from 50% for previous regimens. Plus, a treatment for two key groups often left out of TB treatment research. Dr. Francesca Conradi led the study called BEAT Tuberculosis.
We found safe and effective treatment for pregnant women and children, but also we've awakened the field to say, actually, this has to be done.
Women, children, and men in the BEAT Tuberculosis trial all received the same regimen. That's a change from previous treatments, even though TB often affects entire families.
The daddy gets one easy regimen to take, and then the mom gets a more complicated one because she's pregnant, and the child gets an even more complicated one. Dad is cured after 6 months, mom is cured after 8 months, and we wait, or 9 months, we wait for 18 months for us to be able to know if the child is cured. So that's really an unfortunate set of circumstances.
The study shortened treatment of 6 months for everyone, and it did so without the harsh side effects of previous treatments.
People would say to me, Doc, I would rather have TB than the medicines that you're giving me. So in the olden days, they were terrible, and a third of our patients, half of them would lose their hearing.
Dr. Pauline Howell supervised the study. She says the new regimen has the backing of the World Health Organization.
That basically means that countries can take the recommendation of the regimen and run with it, which is fantastic, because the more options we give countries to work with, the more options we can then translate to patients who need treatment.
Leslie Marbury is Southern African Mission Director for the United States Agency for International Development. She says breakthroughs like this new treatment could eventually pave the way for a world free of, or at least less troubled by, TB.
They're coming from high-burden countries like South Africa, who are motivated, then I feel confident that we can end tuberculosis as a global health challenge.
TB claims over 1 million lives each year, but experts say with early detection, simplified treatment regimens, and greater access to life-saving drugs, these deaths can be dramatically reduced. Sahir Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Transparency International released its latest Corruption Perceptions Index today, a barometer of public sector corruption worldwide. The study found that 47 countries out of the 180 it surveyed had their lowest score since it started using the current methodology for its global ranking in 2012. South Sudan slid toward the bottom of the index, displacing Somalia. They were followed by Venezuela and Syria. The U.S. went from 24th place to 28th. Denmark held on to its first place, followed by Finland and Singapore. U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday announced a 25% tariff on aluminum and steel tariffs that could hit Canada and Mexico, the top two exporters to the U.S., the hardest. Trump's ongoing trade offensive also provoked chiding from the U.S. top competitor, China. VOA correspondent Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Another shot in President Donald Trump's trade war. On Monday, he announced 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal. This is the beginning of making America rich again.
Howard Lutnick is Trump's nominee to lead the Commerce Department.
You are the president who's standing up for the American steel worker, and I am just tremendously impressed and delighted to stand next to you.
Trump's trade advisor says this move will help domestic producers and support the nation's economic and national security. The biggest foreign steel suppliers, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, and South Korea, are likely to be hit hardest. Earlier Monday, Beijing's additional 10 to 15% tariffs on U.S. goods took effect as a countermeasure to Trump's 10% hike on Chinese goods earlier this month. Guo Jiakun is spokesperson for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
There are no winners in trade wars and tariff wars. What is needed now is not unilateral tariff increases, but equal dialogue and consultation based on mutual respect. We urge the U.S. to correct its wrong practices and stop politicizing and instrumentalizing economic and trade issues.
But Trump says not only rivals, but also allies were taking advantage of the U.S.
We were being pummeled by both friend and foe alike. Our nation requires steel and aluminum to be made in America, not in foreign lands. We need to create, in order to protect our country's future, a resurgence of U.S. manufacturing and production, the likes of which has not been seen for many decades.
Many economists believe tariffs raise consumer prices. Scholars of supply chains and logistics say Trump's move also raises major global policy questions. Professor Sundaresh Haragu of Oklahoma State University.
It's not clear what the, you know, whether this is a negotiating strategy, whether this is going to be permanent, or is this only restricted to Canada, Mexico, and China as it is now, or is it going to expand to, the European Union, for example, or even the BRICS countries, of which, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and 12 or 14 other countries are part of.
These concerns may prompt countries to realign their trade relationships, he said, which will likely alarm producers.
Businesses, again, hate uncertainty, so they're going to put everything on pause. That means, there's could be a decrease in production activity, while at the same time the tariffs could have inflationary effects.
Some in the U.S. automotive industry, headquartered in Detroit, Michigan, echoed that concern. Glenn Stevens Jr. is executive director of Mitch Auto and the Detroit Regional Chamber's vice president of automotive and mobility initiatives.
Sudden tariffs to a system, there isn't a lot of good that comes out of that.
Trump has moved lightning fast on this issue in his second term.
We'll also be announcing steel tariffs on Monday.
Tomorrow?
U.S. trade partners have warned that the tariffs could hurt automakers, shipbuilders, and other U.S. industries. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mukbil Yabaro in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.